Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. Continuing here on the Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. There was an article in the New York Times over the weekend called "For Obama, an Unexpected Legacy of Two Full Terms of War," saying that President Barack Obama, with 8 months left in office, is the person who served the longest constantly at war in the history of the United States, and that there were nine nations that have been engaged in war by the United States over the course of that time. And what does that mean for where we are? We're going to wrestle with that a bit. And there was an interesting piece by a woman, a thinker, an author who has been an activist, who's been on the show many times, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, a Native American activist who wrote the Indigenous People's History of the United States. And she wrote a very interesting thing about this to just make America remember before we jump into our panel and introduce them to you, where she wrote, she said a couple of days ago in a speech responding to that article, she wrote that President James Monroe's ties with Obama, the first Seminole War, 1816 to 1823, the army commanded by General Andrew Jackson, who as president oversaw the Second Seminole War, which Martin Van Buren continued 1835 to 1842. The Third Seminole War from 1855 to 1858 was overseen by two different presidents, Pierce and Buchanan, a pattern very similar to the Iraq Wars, 1991 and ongoing. The Seminole Wars were formative for future invasive wars that have been endless. Few days in U.S. history without U.S. military making war somewhere. I found that kind of very interesting piece to think about in the process of this, that we often forget that the wars with Native people in this country went on longer than anything. But and she argues as precursor to what we're seeing now, which we'll argue out and discuss about where this is all taking us. We're joined once again by Dr. Tabit Abdullah, who is an associate professor of Middle East history at York University in Toronto. Has been joining us for many years. Tabit, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Zain Al-Amin is a teacher, writer, and activist, host of radio show Shay Wanana on WPFW. Did I say that right, Zain?
That's right, yeah.
I just make sure you got it right. Good. Which centers on politics and culture in the Middle East. And Doug Ollivant, who is senior fellow of the New America's Future of War Initiative, is a retired lieutenant colonel of the United States Army, whose last assignment in government was as director for Iraq at the National Security Council during both President Bush and President Obama's administrations. And Doug, good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be invited.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org for email. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on our Facebook pages. But do call 410-319-8888. If you're listening to us far away, you can call or email us at talk@steinershow.org. But let me just start with you for a moment. I found Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's historical analysis of how long we have been at war before in this country. When she talked about the Seminole Wars, is kind of an interesting analysis about the kind of formative way that we created war politics in America. What did you think of her analysis?
I think there are some ways in which it's very similar. The idea of having wars on the periphery in which the main part of the population is not engaged, not even thinking about it, having a very small professional army that's out front doing these tasks on the behalf of the government, whether the people are engaged or not, there are some similarities there. On the other hand, I don't think that what is going on in the Middle East compares to, you know, what some of us argue is a genocidal campaign against the Native Americans in our own country. There's a distinction of kind to be made there.
So let's jump into where we are now. I think it would be an interesting conversation to have one day, a long conversation with Roxanne and others just about that analysis. But, you know, when we look at where we are in this war, and I know that we've covered Tabit was where we first met, the intensity of the lead-up to the Iraq War, which, you know, which I know in our conversations you opposed that the lead-up to the war in Iraq and the war in Iraq as a man in exile from Iraq. But you also say that where we are now is, at least if I get it right, is almost inevitable in terms of the wars we're fighting because of what was created. So what is your analysis of this constant war, Tabit?
Yeah, it's been a long time, Mark. First time we spoke was when the United States was massing, and I was living in Syria, actually.
Exactly. Right.
Well, it's not necessarily a new era in the Middle East. The problems of the Middle East are ones that are quite deep. Where we stand today, I think the United States is still going to be very, very much concerned with the Middle East for many years to come. There is the issue of oil. It's true that under Obama's administration, the United States is weaning itself off of dependence on international oil, but the Middle East still has half of the world's oil reserves, and the oil market is a unified market, and therefore the control of oil pricing and oil supply and the flow of oil is extremely important for the most powerful country in the world, the largest imperial power in the world, which is the United States. So it will continue to be engaged. Secondly, Israeli security. That was a very important factor for American strategy in the Middle East. That existed before the Iraq War. It will continue to exist. For many reasons, America is very much concerned with the issue of the position of Israel. There is a new thing that has come out as a result of the turmoil that began with the American invasion of Iraq, but who knows, it might have happened anyway, and that is the flow of refugees now that's really affecting Europe and affecting the political engagement of the world with the Middle East. This, I think, will also continue for many years, perhaps even decades to come, because I don't see a quick resolution of the problems in the region. And fourthly, the United States will continue to be very much engaged because a fear of a void existing there if they pull out. So the Iraq War, of course, it's an important event, but almost all of these factors that I listed existed before the Iraq War. And though Obama agree with much of what Obama's policies are, but I think that he will continue to be shackled with these four points that I mentioned.
Zane.
Yes.
Just
Mark.
Kind of jump in about your analysis of where we are and this notion that we're in this constant war that nobody can figure out how to end.
Of course, the Obama administration is very instructive in how the Democratic Party extends war beyond the appetite of the American people. And it's by changing its shape, changing its form. What's instructive right now what's most instructive about that is a look at Obama's chiding of Rutgers University students for rejecting Condoleezza Rice as the speaker at their graduation. And he says he insisted that that if they had invited her and listened to what she had to say, it's better than rejecting her, as if there's a mystery as to what Condoleezza Rice stands for. Another thing that's really apparent is how even in popular culture, there are jokes about now about Obama lobbing bombs from afar. That the kind of aggression on the Middle East has changed its form, and it's a kind of a remote war, and therefore that should be less acceptable. Even though the Obama administration has actually sold 30% more in weaponry than the Bush Jr. administration. They've beat them in terms of weapons sales. And in every intervention, in every policy, whether it's related to Israel, Middle East, Israel, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, nothing has really change except the form of, the way he is intervening in things at this point. His relationship with Saudi Arabia is most telling. He has visited Saudi Arabia. Obama has visited Saudi Arabia 5 times. The last time, the king didn't even receive him on the tarmac, and yet he continues to visit and to provide weaponry to Saudi Arabia and to feed the war in Yemen, and then to send to send boots on the ground into Yemen to as a corrective measure of the mess that they made, that the Saudi coalition has made. So all this to say is that Obama has managed to extend this endless war in a different form, in a stealth form that was under the radar for a while, but now as people are talking about his legacy, it's becoming visible again.
So Doug, let me ask you, I mean, as someone who's been in the middle of this fray, literally and figuratively, literally as a soldier, but figuratively, but also in terms of planning and thinking out where what America's involvement has been and
right.
will be. I mean, so where do you think we are in terms of this place of being in endless war? And which is really what, in some ways, you know, what Roxanne's analysis was about, that we are in this place where whatever we have created, whether you agreed with the invasion of Iraq or not by President Bush, that what has happened as a result of all these wars we've been in is like fires across the Middle East with the Islamic State and more. So, I mean, is there a strategy? Is there any strategic thinking about what this really means?
Well, I think the problem is there is strategic thinking, but it's wrong and it's bad. We have for, you know, 50 years, arguably 100 years, the strategy of the United States and the West with respect to the region has been to rely on these authoritarian states to maintain order and keep the trains running on time. I think this started to collapse with the Saddam Hussein regime, and I agree with your other speakers that certainly our invasion of Iraq metastasized this, accelerated it, made it more difficult to deal with. But the larger trends are much larger than what happened in Iraq. This is about these authoritarian regimes that are simply unstable, that don't allow any political participation, that have no plan for the economic participation of their citizens, that are oppressive, and this just wasn't stable. It was eventually going to all collapse. Now, we could just sit back and let it collapse, but we have interest in the region. As one of your speakers said, we are vested in the security of Israel, but there are also oil flows. There are the refugees that are moving into Europe, and at a rate that's unsustainable. You know, I think these populations are going to migrate there eventually over time, but it has happened on fast forward in a way that Europe is simply unprepared to deal with, and that destabilizes our allies there. And then, of course, we have the terrorism problem that's a piece of all this. But I think this all comes back to our strategy has been to support these authoritarian regimes, and as we saw after 2011, these just aren't stable. And it's not all about the United States. Yes, we overthrew Iraq. We certainly gave Libya a push, but Tunisia, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Iran, where they either had successful or unsuccessful revolutions, we didn't have very much to do with that. So here we are trying to manage this situation. And the president has made it very clear he would love to be out of there. We just can't seem to find a way to do it.
So we have to take a short break, and I'm going to come back to the point you left off with and turn to Tawfiq Abdullah and the folks calling in at 410-319-8888. Ben and the others are going to get your calls as well. Talking about a very vital topic about where we are going as a nation and a world in what seems to be a constant, endless war. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're here, as you heard before we went to break, with Doug Ollivant, a senior fellow at the New America's Future of War Initiative, and a retired Army officer who also served on the Security Council under both Bush and Obama, Zain El Amin, who is a teacher, writer, and activist, who hosts Shewanana on WPFW, which centers on politics and culture of the Middle East. Dr. Tabat Abdullah, author, teacher, associate professor of Middle East history at York University in Toronto, and you all are 410-319-8888. And Ben, we're coming to your call, but after I turn this over to Tabat for a moment. I mean, this is the point I think that when you look at the history of the Middle East, and I saw the article in the New York Times that talked about all the lines being drawn after 1918 and World War I that divided the Middle East, and King Faisal after the war.
Yesterday, by the way. Yesterday is the anniversary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement.
That's a good place to start.
The 100th anniversary.
Isn't this a fortuitous moment to have this conversation? Mm-hmm. So, and where we divided the Middle East, the West divided the Middle East up into these sectors to be run by France and Britain. And Faisal, who helped the British beat the Ottomans, had this Arab territory he was going to control, but that was divided up. So this process of, as Doug was talking about, of authoritarian rulers keeping the trains running on time, we kind of blew that up while we also created it. And I think that how do you factor all that into the analysis?
To an extent, Mark, you know, look, I share very much in the and the frustration that I felt Yorgez Zain el-Amin was displaying. Of course I do, and all my when I was in the Middle East, of course I was a strong, you know, activist against what we termed, you know, American and British imperialism and so on. But it's also wrong to think that it's just the West that created the Middle East. This is, in my opinion, sort of a reverse form of biased thinking. It's as if the people of the Middle East are these helpless, mob that can just be molded and created. The Sykes-Picot didn't really create the modern Middle East. It maneuvered through the various forces that were creating the modern Middle East. And likewise, today the United States is not just keeping authoritarian regimes in power. It sometimes it bolsters them, sometimes it doesn't. I think the main problems of the Middle East are internal to the Middle East. It's just that the United States has not always been a helpful factor in this. I sympathize actually greatly with what President Obama has attempted to do in the Middle East, but he's shackled. There's not there is so much, only so much that even the all-powerful imperial power of the United States can do. My issues with the United States is that there's a sense of hypocrisy that creates incredible anger and bitterment in among the Arab people, especially. I mean, on the question of democracy, regime support. On the one hand, of course, support is given to Saudi Arabia, whereas it condemns Gaddafi, and Saudi Arabia, in many ways, is more nefarious than Gaddafi was. The United States is not seen as an honest broker in the Arab-Israeli conflict. And there's the ongoing problem of intense militarization. The 41% of U.S. arms go to the U.S. arms sales go to the Middle East. Nearly $40 billion have been sent to the Gulf, and $60 billion to Saudi Arabia. Just today, it was announced in the Israeli press. These kind of policies don't help. On the other hand, I think that Obama's attempt to disengage from overt military participation, I think the fact that he's often been critical even of Saudi Arabia, I mean, these are good signs. But it really is up to the people of the region to push for more positive change and to push the United States to take better positions. I don't blame the West and the United States for everything that's going on in the Middle East.
So,
Mark, can I...
Is this Zain?
A little bit? This is Zain.
Go ahead, Zain.
Zain. And I agree. It's not the problem of the United States. Most countries in the Arab world are so engaged with the chess game that is U.S. imperialism, the heavy hand of U.S. imperialism. We're not talking about a guy that really, you know, cares. I mean, look at his reaction during the carpet bombardment of Gaza, you know, where 500 kids were killed. It was totally pro-Israeli. Yeah. The military-industrial complex is a huge factor in determining. It's not just oil. It's also the military-industrial complex. But even it goes beyond that. The Obama administration in the past week honored Henry Kissinger, you know, the most Machiavellian mass murderer in the history of U.S. politics was honored by the Obama administration. We're not talking about an administration that can do any good in the Middle East or intends to do any good. It's totally shackled. But at the same time, we're not talking about every other regime in the Middle East is an authoritarian, corrupt regime that's not looking for the long-term interest of their own people. There's no question about it. But the United States is fixated on the one or two dictators that they don't like, and that's where there's a fetishizing of that country, and there's a fetishizing of the refugees and the results of that war. So this is really the big picture. There's no the blame is to blame the U.S. completely is wrong, but the U.S.'s intention, the U.S. government's intention, is not good. But I'm very heartened about the next generation of Americans who seem to be more in tune than my own generation of Americans about what's going on and what they need to resist, and they have no appetite for this.
And I think I that's why I think, well, let me get a call in here. I'm going to go to Doug and go around the room again with this question I've been thinking about. 410-319-8888. Ben, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I've been having a sense about the Middle East war the past 10 years. And I was trying to ask your panel a specific question regarding just oil and what the result is going to be for the countries near the Middle East, some of the African countries. I feel that the United States will be slowly but surely leaving, the reliance on oil, mainly because we're, bringing some of our own oil and also relying on, electric cars such as Elon Musk, what he's planning to put out, and the level of support that he's having for the government. I feel like the destabilization of these oil countries affect the countries near it, such as the African countries that rely on oil, and maybe looking into 30, 40, 50 years from now. How is that affecting those countries?
That's a really good question, Ben. Doug, did you hear the question?
I think I have the gist of it. You know, what's going on with oil, given the change in that market,
and how it destabilizes nations around it, the nations of East Africa, and the places that rely on this oil, and China's role in moving to the Middle East. I would add to that, looking for oil as well.
Right. This is an issue, but I think we're not going to see it impact Middle East policy for some time, just because the United States takes so long to reset its policy. I mean, look, today, in 1973, when we had the oil crisis, all the oil tankers that came out of the Persian Gulf did a right turn, came across the Atlantic, and came to the United States. Today, 85, 90% of those tankers make a left turn and go to Asia. They go to China, they go to Japan, they go to Taiwan. We've not really reset and rethought about what that means for United States policy in the region. Yes, it's still a global market, and yes, we're still interested, but if things go south, yet North America is more or less energy independent. So how does that change how we think about the Middle East? I don't think we've started to think about that yet.
But, I mean, so
can I say something quickly?
Tom, please do.
Yeah, sorry. Before oil had become was discovered in Kuwait, the majority of people who lived in Kuwait, the majority of Kuwaitis, were very much in favor of unity with Iraq. Once the oil was discovered, things changed. Petroleum has played a huge role in shaping the modern Middle East. But petroleum is not just important for fuel, and it's not just important for the United States. It goes into plastics manufacturing. It goes into fertilizers. It goes into lubricants. It will continue to be an extremely important commodity for the world economy for many, many, many years to come. So the move of the United States to a greater self-reliance, I don't think will change the dynamics too much. Even though Saudi Arabia has been claiming, you know, that it's going to move away from its addiction to oil, as the prince mentioned, I doubt that there'll be much change.
So, when you hear it, and you know, this will be part of the presidential race coming up here in the United States over our policies in the Middle East, and but I beyond that. I mean, what I was trying to probe earlier is what should be our policy? I mean, how do we begin to wrap our hands around what is being faced? People who opposed, from the people who opposed war in Iraq from the beginning to those who now really, really vociferously fight to end the drone wars in Yemen and having our troops in Yemen and Syria and Iraq in small numbers to fight the Islamic State to how we kind of going after Gaddafi, and Gaddafi now is kind of we now have a country that is anarchic at best, and so we look at what's happening in both Egypt and Saudi Arabia, some people will say we should just withdraw militarily completely from the region, and we have to have a different policy. But if that was the case, what would that do, and what would that policy be? I mean, I think that's something that we hear too little about. What is the alternative to where we are now? And I know that. Let me just very quickly turn to Zane and then Doug and Tobit, because I think Zane, you're probably one of those who does believe that we need to withdraw, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, I teach at the University of Maryland. I teach global literature and social change, and when we go around the world and we read about all the interventions and all the harm that the U.S. has done, there's a simple thing, is that one of my students came up with a conclusion is the answer is to do no harm. And it's as simplistic as saying no blood for oil, which was called by the mainstream media as a very simplistic slogan. But the reality is you have to look at something like the nuclear pact with Iran. That's the one positive thing that the Obama administration, that's the only time that I felt the Obama administration had good intentions and did something that contributes to the peace in the region. Everything else they did what has contributed to turmoil. The Arab Spring has failed in many countries. But we saw an awakening that will continue, that we saw the presence of a force, a positive force on the ground that can change things. Now, if the U.S. Stops intervening in these countries and stops feeding the military-industrial complex and in this irrational way that's causing havoc in the region, we can focus on these forces. Our forces on the ground, wherever it is in the Middle East, can be more effective in fighting for their rights and fighting against these authoritarian regimes that hover over them.
So, Doug, I mean, what hearing what Zane is saying, I think that there's which is a very serious position on where we take it. I mean, what consequence would that be in your analysis, and where do you think we would go?
I think there's a lot to be said for having a very modest view of what the United States can do in the Middle East. I mean, the idea that we can control outcomes is simply hubristic. That's not going to happen. On the other hand, I do think that there are places where the United States can help trends that are moving forward. For example, in Libya, I think there is a clear role for the United States in getting the three rival governments together to get their act together, to get that country resuscitated, fight the Islamic State, reduce the refugee flows, that could be done at a very minimal cost and very few people in the country, just requiring a lot of diplomatic attention. But I think I don't disagree with the concept that the United States' intervention in the region as a whole has been unhelpful in the main.
So, Tabit?
I would say I agree with some of the points that Zane mentioned, and I disagree with others. I agree completely with what he said about the Arab Spring. This was a wonderful, demonstration and a reminder to all of us that there really is a people in the Middle East with an independent mindset that could in many ways defy seemingly overwhelming odds. And I also am very optimistic that the Arab Spring is not completely dead, that even if it's suppressed, and most notably in Egypt, that it's already opened the Pandora's box, and I don't think the lid can be put back on. It will be revisited, and it will be a point for future activists to constantly refer to and learn from. So I think the Arab Spring is a wonderfully optimistic event in the Middle East. I don't agree, however, with the notion that the United States should simply withdraw from the region. I don't agree with that. I think the United States has participated in much of the problems of the Middle East, and for America to wash its hands and to withdraw, you know, with the applause of progressives in America, is a cop-out. And I take Iraq as an important case in that. I think the United States can play a very positive role in trying to mediate between the contending parties, in trying to support the forces that are fighting against this evil Daesh or ISIL in the region. And I think the United States can continue to be a very important player in economic development. But for the United States to simply cut and leave a region that, you know, again, I repeat, I don't think the problems were created by America, but America played an important role in these problems is a cop-out. It's immoral, in my opinion, and it's also counterproductive. I think the United States can play a much better role in the resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. You know, if there was a state in the West Bank and Gaza, probably 90% of the problems of the Middle East would evaporate within a very short time. So much of the tensions there are related to this issue. Now, of course, I'm not going to be a dreamer and say that the United States all of a sudden is going to transform into this progressive force. But I think it should be the role of commentators, progressives, activists, to push for better U.S. policies rather than for no U.S. involvement.
Well, I think what you outlined earlier, Tavid, this is the conundrum.
Yeah.
Right?
It's a conundrum. Look, there are no easy solutions here. You know, and in many ways, this is why I'm sympathetic to President Obama. I feel that he has the best of intentions, but the hurricane that is the Middle East is one that is almost impossible to have a very pure, positive involvement with. I mean, any force, whether it's the United States, Russia, China, Britain, France, whoever, any force that today gets involved in the Middle East will end up dirtying their hands. So, and that's primarily the result of the internal conflicts of the region.
So we're closing out the conversation here, but on way back to hearing Doug, Zane, why don't you respond to Tabit and what he said in terms of critique of the progressive progressive...
Well, I mean, you know, there's whatever... The main thing to remember is that the Obama administration has been unbelievably incompetent in its intervention. Look at what's happening in Syria. Look at the maneuvering that's happening in Syria. We have forces that are backed up by the CIA and forces that are backed up by the Pentagon that are fighting each other. That makes absolutely no sense. And the amount of money and resources that are being pumped into that. But on top of that, in the wake of the Russian intervention into the conflict, now Obama wants to send 250 people up to special forces to be on the ground there. That's preposterous. People in the Middle East are laughing at this. There's not a place except Iran where Obama has acted competently or where he hasn't caused harm in these countries. And that the litmus test, you always go back to how he deals with the Palestinian people and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and you'll see where his alliances stand. And God help us if we get Hillary Clinton as a president, because it's going to be much, much more worse. But the hope, again, is in a generation that's rejecting the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and seeing them as completing each other when it comes to U.S. imperialism. For the first time in my life, I see this, and I see hope in this.
So, Doug, let me bring you back here as we round out the conversation to kind of leap into this. Because we are at I don't know what I'm not sure what a Trump foreign policy would be. I'm afraid to think about
it.
But we do have a sense of what the Clinton policy would be. So your thoughts on what we just heard?
Well, I think there's a lot of wisdom in what's being said here. The core thing that is going on right now, I think, is the collapse of these regimes, or at least the tension in some of these regimes, and the emergence of, you know, what we loosely called Arab Spring, the aspirations of the peoples in these states to have their voices heard in some way, shape, or form that has not been allowed to date. And that's really laudable. It's also really destabilizing and is creating tensions in the region. It's a positive force, but the effects can be negative, and that's going to have to be managed. The idea of pulling the United States out of the region, I know, is very tempting. And, you know, if we're to believe some of candidate Trump's rhetoric, he seems to be leaning that direction. But I would say the United States is so entangled that to extend the metaphor, to pull the United States out of there would create a number of rips and tears and wounds that might be worse than just leaving the United States in place and trying to change the policies.
Well, I also just curious from your strategic point of view as somebody who served the National Security Council. I mean, what Tobit was saying, and many people say, you know, that the Israeli-Palestinian issue is part of the core, maybe not as deep as it was once, but part of the core of what's blowing up the Middle East. And I think many people in the Arab world do not see America, the United States of America, as an honest broker.
I think that's certainly the case. That is still an issue in the region. I mean, I spend time in the region. You certainly hear about it there in a way you do not hear about it in the United States. It remains salient, although I agree with you, probably not as much as it was 15 years ago. There are now other fish to fry in terms of Daesh, in terms of the collapse of these states, the resurgence of the regime in Egypt, what's happening in Iran. They now have other concerns other than the Israeli-Palestine conflict. That doesn't mean it's not still salient.
So, you know, I didn't expect the four of us to resolve the issue before we left the...
do we have time for other comments?
Yeah, Tobin, we have about a minute. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, one thing that we didn't touch on in this discussion, I guess, you know, we won't have time now, but perhaps, you know, a suggestion, is how this continuous military involvement of U.S. presidents, especially after World War II, has changed the nature of the executive in the United States and posed a real danger to the checks and balances and U.S. democracy at home. I mean, the Middle East, in a way, has shaped American politics so that it has affected its domestic nature by increasing the powers of the executive in ways that are terrifying, actually.
That would be a grist for a discussion, I think, in the future. Just to focus in on that would really be important. And let me just, Zane, do you have a quick final thought?
No, the only thought I have is to reiterate that there's openings right now in the U.S. politically, especially with the changing when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is at the heart of foreign policy in the Middle East, that there's a changing, the opinion about that conflict is changing among the millennials, and that's an opening. There isn't much excuses. There aren't many excuses for politicians now to support Israel on this conflict when the whole future in terms of public opinion is shifting towards in sympathy with the Palestinian people. And that's one place where politicians, U.S. politicians, have a big field to move into.
Well, I'm going to thank the three of you. This has been a great discussion from all across the board, which I think we really need to have more of here. You heard Zain Al-Amin, a teacher, writer, and activist at Shewanana Radio at WPFW. Dr. Tabet Abdallah has been on the show many, many times. Dear friend, Associate Professor of Middle East History at York University in Toronto. Doug Olivant, Senior Fellow of the New America's Future War Initiative. Doug, glad you could join us. Hope you'll come back.
Pleasure.
It was good to have you all three. Thank you so much, very much.
Thank you so much, Mark.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Minister Carlos Mohammed, the Nation of Islam Temple here in Baltimore, Maryland, to reflect back in the early 90s when the NOI had the contract in the housing projects that cut crime and changed the nature of living in those communities. So stay with us as we reflect on a different way of thinking about public safety in Baltimore.